I'm happy to be here. I should have plenty of time in this hour to take questions, as I have heard is the style. That's fine with me. It's a nice size audience. This is mostly work done at Berkeley, infused with a little bit of information I have from Google, so that I could talk about it. But you should view it as not representing Google. So we build giant scale services. We have for about 17, 18 years now, starting in the mid 90s. And they tend to have this format, which is the front end. The traffic goes through there. You make it highly available, so you can have a single set of IP addresses to go to that don't go away. We typically then send traffic to stateless workers, mostly for fault tolerance. And then we actually want durable storage. It's in some lower system, which could be a database or a big file system like Bigtable or Spanner. And many, many services fit this model, particularly live services. Certainly all the Google services fit this model, and many at many other companies. All of the Inc2me stuff fit this model. And it's trivially parallelizable. That's one reason we use it, typically parallelized by users. And latency matters a lot. That's one big difference between services and traditional parallel computing, is we really care not about throughput or kind of overall performance. We care really about latency. And these are all various factoids. They're kind of outdated, frankly. No one's bothered to redo these studies, but Google's published that if they add a half a second to their search results, the number of page views goes down by a lot. They discovered this because they actually wanted to increase the number of results in the default set from 10 to 30, because users asked for 30, and it turns out when they gave users 30, less users came. Right, it's because the 30 result page took longer to load, and that actually trumps having the extra results, even though users never thought about it. Amazon has said that every 100 milliseconds costs them 1% in sales. That seems hard to believe. You can't really distinguish 100 milliseconds. About 250 is your limit, but nonetheless, it's something they've published. And then there's a whole bunch of other studies from third parties about what happens if you add a second to your interaction time. And they're all bad. So one reason we use parallelism is basically to reduce the latency, right? Think of a search engine, we're searching petabyte of data. You can't get through a petabyte of data other than by having many, many, many parallel disks, right? You need thousands and thousands of disks to get through that much data in a short amount of time. So parallelism is the only answer. And it looks typically something like this via fan out. This is the actual rough structure of Google search. Query comes in the top in the web server, which then in parallel looks up the search and the ads. The search engine is itself many actual engines, so you fan out kind of into different vertical search engines like shopping or images. And then each of those is themselves a fan out to many, many nodes to actually do the query. And again, this structure follows from wanting to have low latency. There is no other structure that would work. This picture is from Jeff Dean, who talked about latency last year at Berkeley. More interesting is the tail latency, which is really, tail is the tail of the distribution. So here's a PDF, and as you go out to the tail at 99% or more, you want to make sure that latency is also low. Right? You want all your users to have a good experience. And in fact, this is, I would say, maybe the hardest thing we have to do right now. It's easy if you want to improve the average latency. You can add more servers. You can spread the data out more thinly. You can do more caching. Those don't help with the tail latency. I'll get more into that in a minute. But just to make sure we're all on the same page, what I mean is really, how bad is it when things aren't perfect? And is it okay for your users to still have that latency? And this is, I think, one of the important parts of the first half of this talk, right, which is that all the tricks we use tend to hurt our tail latency, or at least not help it. And so anything that's in the flavor of caching or prediction, right, your prediction is wrong more than 1% of the time. Therefore, in those cases, you've made the situation worse. Right, so it's exactly a trade-off between the average case is better and the tail is worse. Parallelism, although it reduces our latency, it also by definition, because these are essentially things where you need all of the results, or most of the results, you're limited by the slowest of your parallel tasks. And so in particular, what we see is uneven response time across many, many servers, and then the slow ones, called the stragglers, are what limit you. More subtly is actually virtualization, which is widely used in the cloud space, actually less so at Google. Google historically doesn't use virtual machines. I'm not releasing a big secret there, although I couldn't find it documented anywhere. The history behind that's a little interesting. I think the real reason is the time Google needed to do this, virtual machines weren't ready. And then so they deployed a whole bunch of stuff without virtual machines. Now it's too late. they've reintroduced virtual machines for their cloud offering, the Google Cloud Engine. That, of course, does use virtual machines because of untrusted code. I'll come back to this topic in a minute. But if you just ignore VMs and their role as in the cloud as you think of them, just focus more on virtualization, the concept, you're hiding the real resources, right? It is not a good thing for predictability, and it's not a good thing for tail latency, right? So we've added a layer of scheduling, we've added a layer that hides memory pressure. Virtual machines are notorious for wasting a lot of memory because each virtual machine needs its own large amount of memory. It's hard to not impossible, but hard to reuse the memory across different jobs. And of course, it's much worse if your virtual machine doesn't directly map onto the physical machine underneath it, which is pretty common. Question?
So which is the important thing, the virtualization of hardware or Google scheduling?
Virtualization does a few things. Co-scheduling is probably the most important. If you are really running 5 cores on 4, there's no way to hide that.
Right.
That'll be worse than anything. But even if you're running 4 cores on 4, there's still extra things going on because if you're using KVM, you're running on top of Linux, and there's background tasks, and you might not have your memory in the right memory banks for even performance. Depends on what socket you're accessing them from. There's the way the network handling goes, and the interrupt handling is actually quite different, and that can be a source of interference and side effect that affects predictability. So I've been using this phrase for a little while, which is this virtualization is a kind of a lie, which we've known. We never claimed virtualization was the real thing, but it usually doesn't matter that it's a lie. When it matters is when it's tail latency, right? You can't hide it there. So in fact, if you wanted to write a program that could tell if you're on a virtual machine or not, the easiest way to do that would be to look at the tail latency of what it is you're doing. If you have high variance, you're probably on a virtual machine, and if you don't, you're probably not. Right? That depends a lot on the other things like Linux that might affect that, because Linux is itself going to introduce variance. Right? And another one that fits this category that you don't think about is our extensive use of logs in the cloud. Right? Most storage systems are written by you write to the log because we're trying to avoid seeks on sequential writes. We're trying to avoid seeks on random writes, so we write sequentially. That's great for writes. Later, we have to essentially garbage collect that log and do what's called compaction and then move it somewhere else. So Bigtable does that, Spanner does it in the background, SQL servers do it in some cases. It shows up, depends how they're implemented. But bottom line is, anytime you're doing background tasks that you've created for yourself, that's gonna change your predictability, because when you run those tasks, something else is running slower. Right, so now, even though it's your service, you're making, or the JVM is a good example. You're running on top of Java, Java garbage collects, you can't hide that from the tail latency.
So why not run everything on a blue chip?
In a what?
Why not run everything on a blue chip? Cleanest machine there is in terms of timing,
I will answer that question in a few slides.
Oh.
Not literally that question, but the essence of that question.
Right.
So here's a little chart from the Tail at Scale paper by Jeff Dean and Luis Barroso. It just says if you have a fan out and it takes 1 millisecond to do a single leaf, but there's some variance, and this is from a real Google service, they don't actually say which one, and in fact I don't know which one. The point is just the fact you have a parallel set means that the tail latency is gonna get worse the more you have to wait for, right? It's just statistics, right? There's no magic here. But it is a real effect, and it's very hard to hide. The only way you could hide it, of course, is to reduce the variance of the individual tasks, right? Because you're aggregating that variance when you do a barrier at the end of them. So here's a straw man, which is not dissimilar from the blue jean straw man. We'll allocate... dedicated resources to all the live services. Sure.
So we have, I thought the way that you guys killed that latency was just chop off the outliers.
For something like MapReduce, it's in the MapReduce paper that they I guess we, it's not my work, but yes, the MapReduce team did catch stragglers. And we'll do that for search as well. If you don't get results within a certain bound, we'll eventually give up. But you need to, you better get most of your results within that bound. And in some cases, you need all the results, depending on what it is, like access control, right? There's things you need 100% answer for. But yes, getting rid of stragglers is definitely one of the options that, that we use, and you should use it. In fact, it's typically easy in the batch case because the work is deterministic and idempotent. You can do it twice. So if you're worried about a straggler, just issue it twice and take the first one. Right. So in fact, a general thing we also use, I would say, is extra parallelization when we start to get worried about things being slow. And in fact, in the fan out, we have, I think this is in the tail of scale paper, for certain reads, you can wait 10 milliseconds. If you haven't gotten an answer, you can issue the same read to another replica, right? Which is wasted work, right? And then there's another clever piece which says, well, we wasted that work, but actually, since we got our answer at 12 milliseconds, we'll go cancel the pending request at the second replica. So there's actually a cancellation mechanism. And with that, you're down to about 1% chance of repeating the work. And only if you actually needed to get to the 10 second to issue the work. Right, so it's, there are lots of techniques in that space. Back to the slides. The straw man would be, of course, that you dedicate resources to live services. You have no other jobs on those machines. Maybe using virtual machines, maybe you don't. But if you're using virtual machines, there's nothing else running on the machine, so the virtualization is not competing with anything. It probably would be okay in that case. You wouldn't have any page faults. And if you really care, you also need to turn off power management, because it turns out it takes a while to wake up from power management. Of course, no background tasks, including your own, like JVM garbage collection. And you also need to make upgrades and failures rare. They can't be zero, but they need to be rare enough that they're well back, well behind in the tail. So this actually works sometimes. We do this sometimes, not this extreme, but this general direction. And the problem with this as a straw man is this, the peak to average ratio. So this data is from Windows, Azure. They're nice enough to publish it. And the important point from this slide really is that their peak to average ratio is something like 4 to 1. Which means if you use the straw man, you have to allocate for your peak all this stuff that's completely dedicated, but on average, it's 75% unutilized. On average, it's unutilized 75% of the time. So we need to share. And by the way, other services are in the range of 3 to 6, or if you count Christmas, 10 difference ratio between peak and average. And I would argue this is fundamental to the cloud. This has been at every place I've been from the very beginning. We launched service in 95. It had a peak to average ratio that was 4 to 1. Right. So it depends a little. You can balance a little bit better if you can mix stuff from different geographies to deal with nighttime. It's better if you don't have a weekend effect, although most services do. It's better if you don't have a seasonal effect, like e-commerce. But depending on which of those effects you have, it's 3 to, I've seen 2. It's been 2 is the lowest, but typically 4 and 10 is possible. So we can't just dedicate stuff. And I'm going to take what seems to be a tangent, but trust me, it's not. Batch computing. We have a huge cluster to handle peak loads. I just told you why. It's got to be giant. And it has to be giant kind of no matter what, because we do need it for the peak, even if we could, if anything wasn't dedicated machines. So that's a big waste. And if you think of it that way, batch computing is free. Right. And I would actually argue that this is the reason we have all these things, including big data. Right? In some sense, big data works because the computing is relatively free. Now, we'll talk about is it really free or not in a second. But I just told you, if I build the cluster I want, it's 75% unutilized. And so all that I can use for batch work all the time. The nice thing about batch work is if I need my cluster back for my peak load, I just stop the batch work. It's batch work. It's very tolerant. Right, so we use this a bunch for pre-computation. In particular, things like Google Maps and book scanning, web indexing, all depend on extensive bash work. You know, millions of hours of bash work, right? Think about the maps case. So you look at your satellite image on your phone, there's never a cloud in it. All the tiles perfectly align, right? All these defects have been fixed in the images that you never saw, right? How does that happen? Well, we take all these images from different times, we color correct them, we find the ones that don't have clouds. So when you see a tile, that tile is a composition of many different particular images such that it can get a full version of the tile that is cloud-free, right? And then you have vegetation in this tile better match the vegetation in this tile, right? So you can do all that, but it's a crazy amount of computation, right? Because images are big, there's new tiles every day. There's no other way to do it, right? And book scanning, web indexing are the same properties. So this works because we can do this in our otherwise unutilized cluster. And it's also much easier to do batch computing exactly because these things are idempotent, easy to restart, and if you want to kill a straggler, it's no big deal. Everything will get corrected for that. And in general, I call this a low-stress service. The live services are stressful, right? Your pager goes off when the latency goes up or the server goes down. Batch work, you don't get pages, right? It'll keep plugging along. It'll be slower. Eventually, everything will complete. So if you don't believe me about free, it shows up in prices if you look carefully. These are the Amazon spot instances. And the spot market is when you want to buy a server for right now. And so it's priced because the spot market fluctuates. So here's the prices for yesterday. And this is a Linux medium instance, which is a commonly used kind of server. And in particular, it's 10 times more expensive to get a server that you can plan on having for a while, which is the kind you'd need for a live service, versus the kind you could use for a batch job. So there's a literal 10x cost difference there. If you're willing to reserve a year in advance, if you all buy the server for a whole year, then it's only 5x. But it's still 5x. So that's how free is. It's not literally free, but it's 10x to 5x. Right? And this is, Google doesn't have an internal spot market, but it's the same phenomenon, right? For the same reasons that the build out for live services is bigger than we need for average. So to summarize kind of the needs of the cloud, there's really two categories. Live service jobs where we want to minimize latency, including the tail latency. And to do that, we're going to minimize layering and virtualization, and we want predictable, efficient performance. And then batch jobs, which will be by definition lower priority, should fill in this peak to average gap, and delays are perfectly fine. Right, so we want to get to this kind of bimodal distribution. It's there already, but we don't do anything in the rest of our systems typically to help it along. In particular, we don't do much that would reduce our latency at the expense of making batch jobs slower, although that would clearly be the right trade-off. So this led my group at Berkeley to start a new OS, which you should cringe just by my saying new OS. NewOS is not a good research project. It's hard to write an OS. It's even harder to get an OS deployed. The last group to try seriously was Singularity at Microsoft, and they did build a whole OS, much more than we're ever going to build. And they learned from it and threw it away. I don't know if Microsoft people would agree with that statement, but it's not replacing Windows, as far as I know. Its goal was to be a research tool, and it was that, and they did learn great stuff from it. This is an OS to be the single node OS in a cloud environment. So it's not going to be a desktop OS. And there's a few things that are interesting about taking that space. First one is the scheduling stuff kind of goes away. There's too many papers on scheduling anyway, so that's fine with me. The scheduling is made at a different level in the system. It's made by the cluster scheduler, not by the actual node. It's more obvious if you're a dedicated node because you clearly have nothing to schedule. You have one job to run. You should just run it. But also, it's different in traditional OS because it really is a server OS and there's no user interface. There's typically one device, which is the network interface. I would say, Google machines often have disks, but many machines that people are building don't have disks. The disks are elsewhere. All right, so that's a perfectly fine spot for them.
Does it have to deal with the scheduler? In other words, does it have to support priority inversion or something like this?
Yes, I'll get to some of that. But so it has pieces of scheduling mechanism, but it doesn't have scheduling policy.
It's not ignorant of
scheduling. No, it will not be ignorant of scheduling. And in general, in this OS, it's really much more of the flavor of make whatever the machine is transparent. So that if you chose, you could optimize for the actual hardware you have. Right? So what you see is what you really have. And you may not choose to optimize for that, but in fact, often people do, and I'll come back to that in a little bit. This is an open source project. Barrett and Kevin and David are the students actively working on it. You can go to the site and see the code, or you can read the papers. There's only really one paper, which was a SOCC 2011 kind of overview of the direction. And the first concept that's in this, which I think will stick past this OS, is the distinction between provisioning resources and allocation of resources, because these have been conflated historically. So provisioning says, I'm going to guarantee you future access to resources, resources being typically cores and memory. Right. You may or may not have those resources now, but I'm going to guarantee that when you need them, you can get them. That's what the guarantee means, future access. And this is what you want for low latency services, because they need to know that when peak comes, they can get the resources they need to actually handle the load. So there's no negotiation at the time you need the resources, because they've already been provisioned. Right? You're guaranteed to get them. Allocation is what's actually being used right now. And so, in particular, if you have an allocation of a core and you've provisioned it, then that core is uninterruptible and unrevocable. Irrevocable. Unrevocable is not a word. Irrevocable. Meaning that no other job is going to take that core from you because it's been provisioned to you. So as long as you want to use it, you can have it. However, if you're not using it, I might give it to somebody else, in which case I need to give it back. So. If you're a batch job, you run typically on allocated resources that are not provisioned, which means they can be revoked at any time. And what will happen is we will tell you your core was revoked. And in 2 to 3 microseconds, we will have given that core to the actual owner. So that's the new mechanism that's here, is fast revocation. It's worth talking about revocation a little bit. It's not on the slide, but historically, parallel computing doesn't deal with revocation of cores. Right, if I go back to the 90s, parallel computing is kind of, you know, in your code, n equals 32. You have 32 cores, and your program will only run with 32 cores because you've actually carefully broken up your arrays and you've done this block structuring stuff. In this world, you really don't get to know how many cores you're going to have exactly ahead of time. You can in the live services case because you can provision them. But for the batch case, for other things that aren't going to be provisioned, you can ask for a number of cores, you might get that number. You might get that number for now and get less later. And so you need to be able to ask for more cores and give up cores that you don't need. Now for batch work, that tends not to be that hard, but it's not part of our usual model for parallel computing.
So are you also handling other resources beyond just cores, like memory?
We're really only handling cores and memory tends to be space partitioned, although we're blessedly playing with games to move the memory around as well. That's harder because you have to put the content somewhere before you get rid of them. But for batch jobs, it's actually one of the things we're looking at is you just take the memory away and you might even kill that job, or you notify the job if it can do something to free up the memory, that's fine. Another mechanism we're looking at is the batch job gives you a victim list. Here's some pages to take if you need memory, which are typically clean pages. ACPM did that from David Sheridan in the late 90s, mid 90s. But yes, all that's up for discussion.
If the revocation is for batch jobs, why does that have to be fast?
It has to be fast because I want to give it back to the low latency job that needs it. I'll put it this way. If I had a low latency job and you told me you're going to steal cores from me, I'd be nervous.
All right.
So it's really to get people to trust that we can take your core and you really can get it back when you need it. You don't get your cache contents, but if you're not page faulting, and you haven't had any load typically on this server anyway, or much, so your cache would probably be cold. But even if it was cold, you'd only have to refresh the cache and you wouldn't have page faults.
How much time would you refresh the cache? Is that comparable to this or is it more?
It's more, but it's spread out over time, and they're already expecting that case. Because their current alternative option is they start a new process somewhere that's even more cold, right, and it has to page everything in. Right. They don't, because they're not really going to run a completely idle spinning server.
Right.
Right. They're going to do something else because it's unrealistic to do that at 80%, at 20% utilization all the time. So, but it's really to give people comfort that they really do own the resource and they really will get it back quickly. And they do get it back quickly. But it's actually very hard to measure the cache time because it depends completely on the application. But
what about the file system cache? That's the other obnoxious resource.
It's the question is about file system cache. There's a couple different answers to that. Some file systems, the cache is actually in the address space of the client, at least for the big table example, things like that. So those will be fine. It's in the memory on their pages. It's really a shared OS file system cache, which Google doesn't use, but others might use. Then some of those, how do you general handle those pages? But people are less worried about that because if you're going to the file system, you're not expecting microseconds anyway. Right? So they're already expecting some variation of various kinds in the file system accesses. Right, the read to remote disk is going to be milliseconds, right? So this is going to be in the noise. All right, so that's a conceptual shift tied directly to the kind of low latency jobs and batch jobs, but implemented at the level of an individual server and enforced at the level of an individual server. The other kind of base assumption in this model, this new OS, is that you're going to have a lot of cores. When you have a lot of cores, you might think about actually space partitioning them, right? So it's pretty easy to, in fact, give a set of cores to a service and give a different set of cores to a different service. And we can actually, with a little bit of carefulness, make sure we can separate them pretty cleanly. Memory's kind of easy to partition. Again, you'll have cache effects, at least in the current architectures, although I think that could be addressed in the future. And you also have a little bit of interference in I/O bandwidth and memory bandwidth, where you have shared buses that you can't perfectly isolate. Memory bandwidth you can do a little bit with the socket level support. If I were to allocate you a whole socket, you'll do better than if I spread your cores across different sockets. For the I/O bus, like PCI or PCIe, there's a little bit you can do there with scheduling, but kind of like weighted fair queuing does the similar things for networking, but it's limited. For memory and cores, I feel like we can do pretty well. And in this model, there's really three levels of scheduling. There's the cluster OS, something like Mesos, that's deciding which services and jobs to run where. Then on the node, you decide which cores to allocate to which jobs. And then the actual scheduling that you would think of as scheduling is actually inside a user-level scheduler that runs in the address space. So I'll come back to that in a second. But this is the structure. And it's worth pointing out here that threads and cores have been confused historically. Right? Threads are a mechanism for concurrency expression, but in practice they're a mechanism to hide blocking due to I/O. Right? Cores are for actual parallelism. Right? So I want to give you the number of cores you need has to do with how much actual parallelism you want. The number of threads you need has to do with how much blocking are you going to do, and therefore how much live state you have to hide on stacks, right? And so really, in this model, cores are managed at the OS level, and threads are managed at the user level. And you can use different thread packages as you like at that level. And in particular, when your thread blocks, you never lose your core. I'll come back to that point, but that's kind of the essence of it. So what we're going to do is we're going to partition our cores in memory, which is vaguely like exakernel. We're going to revoke cores as needed to return them to the rightful owner. And we'll do other things to minimize interference, such as controlling the interrupts and, in general, controlling how things are scheduled. And our mechanism for this is something called a many-core process. And it's basically a process that has k cores, but it has one kernel entry in its in its OS. It's a single address space. And the user level maps its threads onto the K cores with a few important things here. One is we know what K is, and we will know, we notify it if it changes. Although if we're provisioned and we're using all our cores, it won't change. We'll have our threads do the actual blocking for I.O. In particular, every time a thread blocks, the thread blocks, but the multi-core process does not block. Right? It's still your core, and you can run a different thread on that core. Right? So you own the core, you can use it for your next thread. And that part is vaguely similar to scheduler activations. And if you want to time slice your many core process, which is something you can do, you probably wouldn't do it for a live service, but it actually makes sense for other things, then we're also going to gang schedule your cores, because then you can use spin locks. And in fact, all your cores run together, and that actually simplifies a bunch of things. So I don't say it here, but a side effect of this, actually, there's another slide. Sorry, it's on here. Implementation essentially is these process has what we call a vCore map that maps virtual cores onto physical cores. Well, I just told you virtualization is bad, so why am I virtualizing things? All I'm doing here really is virtualizing the processor number. Right? So I want your processor to be numbered 0 to K, but they might be on whatever processor, whatever core you happen to have. And so to make life easier, and I want to move them around maybe to give you, consolidate your cores on the same socket. So they're very slightly virtualized. There's no virtualization in the sense of you're running at ring one instead of ring three, or we're faking out some part of the architecture, or we're sharing something that wasn't shared before. And because we're after better predictability, at least for these as a core mechanism, we're making some changes, some obvious, some not. Longer quanta. There's no reason to interrupt you frequently, because I'm not trying to make sure your keyboard is responsive, right? That's not a goal. Right, so I'll run you longer stretches. I only need to change what I'm doing at the granularity of changing the mix of services, which is relatively rare. Limited interrupts, which means less interference. Careful memory partitioning, and in particular, if you care, no page faults, because we'll just basically put all your code in and the memory you're using in dedicated memory, which is pretty easy to do. We can also use larger pages, called huge pages. I'm not going to talk about that, but there's some other tricks you can play with the VM system. And I should also add that all the syscalls are asynchronous. So every time you do a syscall, it is non-blocking for sure, because it immediately returns. And then later we'll send you an event when it completes. And that's how you makes it easy to implement your user-level thread system. That part's a lot like Capriccio. Question? In practice, those pages would be locked.
And if you ever do get a fault on that page, you're going to halt. I mean, what do you do?
No, the pages are. Sure, I'm sorry, the pages are present. The normal case for these services, and this is in real life too. A lot of times, these pages are actually present all the time. They don't page fault because they're there. So maybe I misunderstood your question. Now, in practice, what we really would do is we would have some number of servers where the memory is loaded already, but they're not running, because we don't need an infinite number of those. And then some other services where the code is loaded some sense, but the memory is actually not allocated, and we can use it for other things. And that memory would be hard to get back quickly, right? But before I need to get it back quickly, I'm going to use the 10 I've already put in the right state. Right? I didn't get into that level of detail here, but you would use a mix of these techniques if you were actually grow, because when you go to average to peak, it's not instantaneous, right? It's actually, you typically have 15 minutes of visibility into when you need to deal with these things. So there's some games you can play at that level too. But you might be wrong. It's not always, you can have a spike quickly sometimes. So you need some capacity that's online quickly. All right. So what does the user level scheduler see? What it sees essentially is its own virtual multiprocessor. What it looks like is K cores in memory, and you're running threads on that, and the system calls are asynchronous. You get events for completions. Like you have an event queue that you pull, and that above that you just see threads. So we've already implemented TBB. We're in the middle of implementing. We've got most of P threads working, and the Go threads, which actually are very good fit. I might come back to that later. above, once you have the user-level threading, all the rest of the code looks the same, right? You just you issue a blocking read, it will block in your user-level thread, and you'll keep your core to do other things. A context switch is faster, but that's kind of cheating comparing it to Linux, because we're not doing much, right? This is mostly user-level transitions with relatively little state. So I don't think we're about 300 nanoseconds for a context switch versus about 1,200, something like that for Linux. All right, so I want to shift topics a little bit. So that's our kind of core OS. What about virtual machines? And I have two takes on virtual machines, and they're both interesting and complementary. So one answer, the Akros view on virtual machines, is we need virtual machines less over time. In this argument, you'd argue that virtual machines were a great technology at the time they came into be because they solved a bunch of problems, but they're not actually the right way to solve the problem. That's part one view. So in particular, because VMs reduce predictability and in some cases efficiency, we'd really like to go to bare metal resources and you run right on the cores, you get the cores directly, you can see them, you know what they are. And we know that this can work. Triton Sort, which you might have heard of from San Diego, blasted away some of the sorting records basically just by having a version that was keenly aware of the actual hardware it was running on and tuned for that. So if you're willing to take the time to tune your service for the hardware you're on, you can get kind of 10x factors. Right? It's not easy and it's brittle because if you move to a new platform, it's going to have to redo the tuning. But for these giant services at least, there's many people that are available to tune them, right? Because the revenue is high and the efficiency gains are important. So you actually want the ability to do that kind of optimization, at least for some of these services. The other reason you might need this less over time is that some of the things that VMs brought when they arrived are now better handled, or are now at least partially handled by containers. In particular, bundling and isolation of all the packages you use and your process numbers, for example. Containers can do that now. There's even support for migration, something called checkpoint restart in user space. It's not, frankly, as good as live migration of VMs yet, but that's just because it's young. I don't see any reason why it shouldn't work very similarly. And this is real migration. It will move your network stack with it. Right. So what it actually does is it pulls out the OS state relative for your process, including the active network connections, bundles that up, you move that to another server, unbundle it, and now the network connections can continue. So it was definitely inspired by live migration of VMs. And containers are much more in the Akros model of being close to the bare metal. So our first answer would be we wouldn't use VMs, we'd use a container-like mechanism instead, and that's more in the style of Akros.
Could that move towards GDU, operating systems, change this calculus?
I would say there's many OS researchy things going on to make VMs less overhead, right? So detecting common pages in different VMs and deduping them, there are several active projects on that. I would say that mostly works. There are other things on better network scheduling and isolation. And all that should continue. I wouldn't suggest it stopped, but they're actually all trying to make up for things that we introduced, right? Whereas the containers, we're not introducing those obstacles. But that's part one. That's the answer that says, I'd rather use containers than VMs. Part two is I'd rather use VMs than containers, right? Because VMs are still useful, they're great for legacy code, especially if you have a new OS, say, if there's no code for your OS. They're great for server consolidation, and they're certainly going to be great for untrusted code, right? Containers are not good for those use cases in general. But there's a nice solution, which is we can just run a virtual machine on top of a many-core process, because a many-core process is essentially an ideal vehicle for a virtual machine because it gives you a very stable fixed number of cores, which is a lot like an actual machine, right? So you have less virtualization to do in some sense in your virtualization layer, because what we're giving you is a raw set of cores that matches quite well with what you want versus, say, KVM, we give you a set of K kernel threads to emulate your K cores. That's a totally more heavyweight solution, right, than what this is. This is very raw. You still have your VM layer. You're still running in that user level in your guest OS rather than the real OS level. but your resources are stable and you have lower interference. And in fact, you can run these side by side with non-VM MCPs. Here's a picture of that. So in this model, the cluster manager is the actual scheduler. It has many nodes, and it can mix however it likes the combination of low latency jobs, batch jobs, and virtual machines. Because they all run on MCPs, they all use some mix of provisioning and allocation. And in fact, you can mix them quite finely even on the same node. Right? And I think that's an advantage we don't typically, that's not something Google can do today, for example. Right? And I don't think anyone can really do this well today. You kind of, KVM gives you some of this. That would be the closest thing. And all three of these, if you squint, use user-level scheduling for their threats. In a VM, it's called the guest OS, but it is user-level scheduling, right? And from the view of MCP, it looks identical, right? We just give the events up to the VM, which in turn gives it to the guest OS, and we don't even know, we don't have to do anything special because there's a VM on top. So let me give you the status of where we are. It's very researchy. The code looks like student code. Writing an OS from scratch is super non-trivial, right? So the students should be applauded for getting it to work at all. Current version is 32 bits, which is not okay for a data center, but it's much easier to do, so we'll do a 64-bit version later. But it does already mix these services and batch work quite well. You can, our test case is basically running things like Fluid Animate and web servers at the same time and varying the number of servers we give to each and seeing that the batch work continues to make progress and that the latency of the web server doesn't change much, right? And so that's true. We have a partial network stack. We have a partial Go port. We don't have anything yet close in the VM space because actually writing a VM on top of an MCP is another non-trivial project. Although I think it's quite doable because it's very similar to what you would do in terms of a KVM style VM. And then we actually haven't bothered to integrate it with a cluster manager. That's not very researchy. It's not particularly hard. Berkeley has one called Mesos. We'll use that by default. The only tricky thing about it is it's written in Java, and we support C, so we have to first port a JVM. Again, nothing rocket science there, but not good for research. So we're trying not to put that on the students. So let me move to a summary and then open it up, because I think there's a lot of various things we could talk about here. My argument is basically that the cloud has different OS needs than what we have for it now, which is Linux. We want predictable low latency services. We want batch work to fill in the gaps that are fundamental. They're not an accident or temporary. And we want to view the Node OS as something that's really a remotely controlled platform. It's not a traditional OS, it's part of a larger system, and we haven't really done anything to take advantage of that. So Acros is our take on this space, where we really try to focus on bare metal access to cores and distinguishing between threads and cores, making use of spatial partitioning and provisioning and allocation, and then really using user-level scheduling to make it look like the threads that you already have. Right, so we really can't run without a user-level scheduler, right? If you wanted exactly K things to run on your K cores, they would run. But in practice, if you wanted to block and do something else, you'd have to have a user-level scheduler. We'll give you several choices, and you can write your own if you don't like them. All right, let me stop here and open it up for questions. And I'm willing to take questions on pretty much any topic, so it can be what we covered. We have actually 13 minutes, so we're good on time.
Hi, Eric. Rick Farrow.
Good to see you, Rick.
So what is the API for this? I mean, if somebody's going to write an application that's going to run on a Keros, they're not going to be using libc, are they?
At the moment, we use libc and pthreads or, TBB.
Okay. There is some portability to this already in the sense that you could take
an application. Yeah, libc runs now.
Okay.
The problem is that we need Java and we need C++, and those things are hard for reasons that really have to do that are actually relatively deeply tied into Linux now, many of the implementations.
Really? Well, that has to do with memory management, I assume.
Memory management is one. Just every time you optimize those runtime systems, you're going to take advantage of obscure calls in Linux to do so. Mm. And I don't blame you for that. But the bottom line is, those are hard to undo.
Right.
Go looks good because if we can get... First, Go's concurrency model is a perfect fit for Akros. It already has a user-level scheduler. It already manages lots of threads, so that's great. It has the fine-grained locking to show off parallelism, mm-hmm. which most languages can't do. But on top of that, most of the Go runtime system is written in Go, right? So we have less to port to get Go to work because we really need to focus on its memory allocation and some of its C libraries. But all the stuff like string management is all written in Go. So once you get the core written, you get the rest of that for free.
Okay, thank you.
But we could do JVM. There's nothing stopping it. It's just it's a lot of work.
Right. Thanks.
Adjusting the mic. So I was actually going to ask a Go question, but now I'm going to reframe. So suppose you could port a JVM. So, I mean, it's a pain in the ass, and you get it implemented, and it's running. I mean, aren't you just bringing back the same problems you had before? I mean, if you run something on top of your predictable OS, now you have this totally unpredictable runtime system that you're living on top of, right? The garbage collector is not real time, etc.
Yeah, I actually think it's hard to make a case that you should use Java for a live service. People that do use Java for live service do so by doing a lot of hand memory management and trying to get the garbage collector either not to run at all or to run only at certain times. So it's not impossible, but if you were to pick what's the best language for predictability and low latency, you wouldn't pick Java.
Right. Yeah, agreed.
But there's many good things written in it, and we'd love to support it. It's widely used for batch work, so Hadoop and things like that. So that'd be fine.
Okay, thanks.
Hey, so I mean, the fundamental problem of latency variability, it seems like you have to have some predictability of everybody sharing resources. Usually not cores, but at least caches, memories, network is a bad one, and future file systems. So to what degree do you have to, when doing scheduling, do you have to understand how much of any given resource is available to start predictively scheduling?
Oh, that's actually why we use the word provisioning. Another word I could have used is capacity planning, which is what you actually do if you're trying to run a giant search engine. You have to know your needs roughly 18 months ahead because you need to pour concrete and do things that have high latency.
Right.
And so everyone that has a serious service, I mean, too big to just buy elastic cores from Amazon, then you need to actually do capacity planning, in which case you are essentially provisioning racks for the future. Right, so this is the same idea where it assumes you have some visibility into your future, or at least conservatively so, because you have to anyway in practice in the bigger services. And then you provision what you think you'll need, and if you don't use it all, that's fine. We'll reuse it for other things.
So okay, that's really where scheduling comes in, and you're solving some of the problem by saying we'll take it away and bring it and give it back to you. But kind of guess knowing what you actually need, how many network links, how many cache lines, how do you predict the amount of resource a given application needs, or is it just reservation all the way?
Well, once you're running at any size at all, you can measure that stuff pretty well. So in fact, we do build spreadsheets as Google now. Not literally spreadsheets, but models that say, for this much QPS, we need this many servers with this kind of memory footprint, right? And we know that from past experience, and that actually predicts quite well. In fact, we use that for also testing out, if I switch from this kind of server A to this kind of server B, which has a different profile, I can do a small amount of testing and I actually predict how many of server B I'm gonna need.
Right? Okay, and
that actually goes back to around 2000. That's a pretty common technique.
So how detailed will those models get? I mean, understand things like cores. And,
they don't have to be very detailed.
Memory capacity.
Right, you just need to look at kind of your overall throughput numbers.
But not things like network links or cache?
Not the number, maybe the bandwidth and maybe the latency.
Okay, so that granularity, okay.
But it's pretty coarse, and that's been fine.
All right.
That's in the giant scale systems paper a little bit from 2001. But that model's dated. But the concept is there.
Hey, I had a question about the user-level scheduler. I wanted to understand what's the interaction, because I understand basically you have this user-level application and yes, so many cores that's reserved, I guess, somehow. And I want to understand what's the interaction with the actual kernel job, which switches thread. And you know, usually what happens is you may have a user level intelligence that go program the kernel scheduler and say, okay, I have this mini thread and this one has some weight and this one has some other weight.
There are no kernel threads.
No, there's not. But I think what
that's
I'm saying
actually
is
not literally true, and I could talk about why if you need to. But generally, that's the model.
I think if the user level scheduler is making all the decisions, does it mean like when you have a thread running on one of the core and it finishes quantum for some at some point, they mean the kernel go notify the user level scheduler and say, okay, what do I do next? Or like, is it what I'm trying to say? Or?
If you want a timer interrupt, we will give you one, and it shows up as the kernel interrupts your user level thread and
yep.
jumps to a point that you pick, which is your entry point for your scheduler.
Yep.
And your scheduler entry point will say, oh, this is a timer interrupt. But it's now all in user level. And it said, oh, should I pick a new thread or not to run? And if so, start the new thread. And the other thread is blocked, so you don't have to do anything for the thread we interrupted.
Okay, so basically the
assumption... That part's very similar to how scheduler activation works.
Right. So I guess the assumption is like when your user level scheduler push a thread to run on the core, most likely it's not going to be interrupted until it's done, basically.
Yes.
Okay. Okay, cool. Thank you.
Yeah. In general, you'll only get interrupted if you ask.
Right. As opposed to like a scheduler where things are preemptible, where everybody has a quantum and a weight per quantum and this kind of thing.
You can implement that given the events we give you.
Right.
But
that's what in user level. I think the point of all of that is if you have low latency application, how expensive it is to, you know, request user level to ask what's next, as opposed to do that everything in the, you know, in the hot path basically, and context switch stuff on, you know, on the fly. I think that's.
I would say the short answer is all those are possible. You could even dedicate a core just to scheduling to figure out what the other cores should do. That would also implementable.
All right, cool. Thank you.
You referred to serious services, ones you couldn't do on EC3, and. I'm always surprised when
that's,
I hear
that's
the
a
next
mistake,
thing,
that's
you know,
fair.
That they're like doing on EC3 now.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering how many of them are there now that you can't do on EC3 besides Google? I mean,
well,
10,
depends how you count, but in the market size for services running on in data centers is still order 100x over what's running on Amazon. Now, most of that's not Google. Most of that is actually private applications. So there's a huge amount of stuff that I think will move into the cloud, right? So cloud is a great place to be, and elasticity is a great property. It's absolutely the right way to do a bunch of this stuff. But at some point, if you're above some number of servers, even with Amazon, you're going to have to talk to them about saying, I want more servers. Like for Netflix,
right.
You don't use the elastic mechanism that we use, right? It's
right,
a different,
right.
It's a contractual mechanism, and that's fine. But it, again, has much more of a provisioning feel than a completely reactive feel.
Yeah, so I'm just trying to get a feel for what's the order of magnitude of how many services there are in the world that really are of that scale. Not just the ones who don't currently use
EC3.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Really
I don't know
couldn't.
Counting them by cycles, it's probably the majority. But by number of services, it's probably small.
Right.
So the node OS idea, this is pretty interesting because you're simplifying what you're doing on an individual server, but on the flip side, you're going to be complicating the cluster scheduler a bit, right? Is that a safe assessment?
I think the complication's already in the cluster scheduler.
Yeah, I was going to say, I would say that cluster schedulers are already a little bit too complicated today, and it's kind of hard to get control of that complexity. And so, is this the right direction to sort of move more into that territory? And can the cluster scheduling systems handle that?
I can say I'm intimately aware with the Google cluster scheduler. It's in some sense in my VP domain. And it is very complicated. And this would make it simpler, although not significantly simpler. But it wouldn't.
Oh, so you think it would make it simpler?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Because it makes it easier to know which resources you can get back easily in the future. Right.
Okay, I see what you're
saying. Probably
saying.
Also just being having your resources be more predictable is going to help too, but that's a secondary.
Right, but then the scheduling algorithms would have to be aware of all of these extra dimensions. How easy is it to get this back?
Already. These are small.
You know, we have this many machines, and these many are. It's easy to get resources back from. These are a little more difficult, and
that will be in the noise compared to. Is it Intel or AMD? Does it have disks or not? Do the disks have space and, right. and bandwidth on them? That kind of stuff is too hard.
Okay.
But yeah, so I'm not to say cluster management is going to be, I would actually say cluster management won't change significantly one way or the other on mm-hmm. this. And it is very complicated. But that's where the policy should be mm-hmm. in general. The Node.js shouldn't be doing policy. It should be implementing what's commanded of it from above, essentially.
Okay.
Less opinions in our OS is what we want.
Last chance, or I'm going to ask another question. All right.
All right.
Okay. I'll ask one. I guess this will be the closing question then. So a lot of this has the flavor of sort of contrasting hard real-time systems with commodity systems and soft real-time systems, right? So you're saying, well, we're going to really guarantee that you get this all the time, 100%. And this is it seems like it's kind of an absolutist standpoint, and it's definitely going to work.
It's a goal.
Fair enough. But I wonder if you've considered something, since what we really care about, or what I gather you care about, is, you know, 99th percentile. So what about if you did something that was a little more akin to statistical multiplexing, where instead of having these bursts, you just made sure that those bursts were all spread out in the system, rather than eliminating them completely? That is to say, you know, there's going to be some sort of jitter that you're just going to get because you're in a real system. Period, right? You have caches, the caches have this bursty behavior, you're going to have all of these performance anomalies that you're just not going to be able to work around. So what if you just embraced the randomness and you said, well, let's just make that all smooth?
Complicated question. I would say we know from fan out that doing things randomly tends to make the tail latency worse. It makes the average better, but it makes the tail latency worse.
I'm not just saying naive randomization, right?
Fair enough. I think more likely is these reactive techniques where when you detect that you're having a tail latency event, mm-hmm. you change your behavior mid-event.
Right.
Right. That is a very unexplored area that I think is ripe. And particularly it's ripe if you have replicas anyway and they're going to give you identical answers and there's no side effects from asking them twice. Right. Which are some big requirements that people haven't thought about, so mm-hmm. they're not generally true. But they could be true, right? We could reduce the penalty, or maybe eliminate the penalty for asking twice in parallel. Like, we don't want to log this user query twice, for example.
Sure.
Just because we asked two servers because the first server was slow, right? The first server is slow and will then do all the work. We have done the work twice, but including all of the logging and a bunch of stuff, we don't want to do twice, right? So I think that if I wasn't using this technique, I would use this technique, the makeup in the middle technique, but I'm actually thinking we should use both.
Okay, great. Okay, there we go.
It's okay. This reminded me of, okay, so I'm in supercomputing. So there, the march is towards exascale, where we're going to be way out of power, but a lot of the same problems, because everybody's marching, I mean, they need really tight synchronization. So there, there's a big tension between wanting to get really low latency and the fact that we cannot afford the power, so we're going to get crappy processors, a lot of variability just in the processors, possibly unreliable processor, blah, blah, blah. Will you see the same thing, or are you just going to spend the money?
I would certainly think there's no reason not to look down both paths. Right now, the beefy cores are quite a bit faster, especially on some of these I/O intensive things. So that, I would say, makes the call for us at the moment. But and I think they will continue to make progress on the power reduction. So if I had to pick right now, I'd say I'd probably stick with slightly beefier cores and hope that the power goes down.
Right.
But we think we will get to the point using these kinds of mechanisms where we can shut down whole sockets and do things where we have cores that are provisioned but not even allocated, then we can start to do more clever things on manage them as a group. And that's not something we've explored at all. And also we can do some things that we're not doing yet, such as migrating processes to get bimodal utilization, meaning you don't really want all your servers at 30% utilization. You'd really like to have 30% of your servers at 100%, not literally, of course, and 70% powered down. All right, so that is starting to become realistic as we make these migratable containers and as we're aware of this kind of moving a whole many-core process at one time, which I think is totally doable.
All right, so then how would you start scheduling power? Because you said what you want to happen, but the cause and effect relationship between, you know, assigning so much power to so much computation is really unknown and highly dependent on the computation and the
It is dependent on the computation. These processors, if you're running, you're using almost the full power. If you're 50%, you don't use 50% of the power, you use 90% of the power.
And I'm thinking dropping the available power, shutting down power portions.
If you
of the
shut
memory,
things down, it's different. But now, you have to go back to what kind of lead time do I have to bring things back up?
Yes.
And I'm telling you, 15 minutes is not a bad bet for a large service where we have many servers already. I feel like we could have servers in this intermediate state of powered up and ready, but not serving traffic, and keep that pool, the warm pool, ahead of the growth of the service.
Right.
And that's the kind of thing I'm thinking about, but and there's bad versions of that. But
it sounds like what you're saying is that the relationship between power and performance is reasonably like stable or unknown for you guys.
We
so you can't predict.
Mostly it's bimodal. It's on or off, which is too bad.
Right.
We don't get any power savings from having lowering our utilization generally.
What about varying frequency?
That's small.
Okay.
Also. Right. The package itself takes a bunch of power, right, just having the server on. So the best thing would be turn off the whole server. And yes, it's going to take you minutes, literally, right, to get it back up. But as long as I don't need it for 15 minutes, then I have minutes.
Right.
Right. So there's a whole range here that's unexplored, basically.
Well, that makes sense.
And by the way, you can't put storage on those nodes if you're going to power them down, because you need them to serve the storage. So.
Right.
You actually need to also think about how you co-locate storage and regular jobs, because they have different opportunities for power down. And that's not being done either.
Okay.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.